You're all very welcome to another episode of You Must Be Joking, a podcast with me, Eric Lawler.
And myself, Will Howie.
And today's guest is one of those rare performers who can do it all. Actor, writer, impressionist, and a man who's making Irish audiences laugh for decades. You'll know him from the usually successful Apparee Match, where his pitch-perfect impressions and razor-sharp satire have become part of Irish comedy folklore. He's smart, he's musical, and he's dangerously good at accents, which means at any point in this chat, we could be talking to five different people. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the amazing, the brilliant, Rich Dad Cooper!
Thank
Rich
you,
Dad.
Thank you, Frank. That's an amazing intro. Can I go now?
Yeah.
You can only go downhill now.
Yeah. So don't say I'm to spoil that, okay?
No, Jesus, no, I'm under pressure now. Have to do five different people at once. That's my main head wreck now from that.
Borderline personality disorder. Like.
Yeah, off. Listen. That's the least of my worries.
So come here, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm good.
You look great.
Yeah.
You look really fit and healthy and all that, yeah.
Thanks very much. Yeah. No, I've reached the point where I kind of go, I need to look after myself. Yep. Do you know what I mean? Because if we were talking about the bike, and I go out on the bike a fair bit. And I've done a few big trips, like Paris to Nice and stuff like that.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's a big charity one.
Yeah.
So you have to raise like $3,000 for your favourite charity. And I mean, it's actually hard to get into it. You have to sign up well in advance and all that. And I've done it for AWARE, so, you know, suicide and mental health and all that kind of stuff. And although that's overrated.
Get a grip of yourself.
That's my dad.
Man up, will you?
My dad used to say that. Like, you know, I'm feeling a bit cramped. He was from Waterford. But he'd say, well, you go ahead and take a walk. Take a walk. It'll make you feel... Now, that his accent was, speaking of accents, he was originally from Waterford and he was trained as a classical tenor.
Okay.
Classically trained tenor. And he was told that he should get elocution lessons because he used to talk like that boy. You know,
he'd be outside the Savoy Cinema and then he'd be going down to Tramore, boy. You know, the dodge him down in Tramore.
So this German fellow who was teaching him said, I think you better get elocution lessons because
they can't understand your accent.
And so Dad got elocution lessons and as a result, he ends up sounding like he's from Johannesburg.
So that's what happens to a Waterford man when he's giving elocution lessons. He sounds as if he's an African.
And
did you get to see? Did you get to see him perform as a?
Yeah,
kid?
I did. Himself and my ma. She was a soprano and he was a tenor, and they met. They actually did a lot of recitals. They were like completely immersed in classical music, right?
Wow.
And they did a lot of recitals on what was called the RE, the Radio Éireann Singers. So it was before even the RTE singers, or, you know, they had a choir and they had an orchestra and all that. And she had to actually, when they got married, she couldn't be in the RTE Singers anymore because it was like, you know, it was because she was married, she had to, being a woman, you had to
be at home.
Yeah, you had to
sing in the kitchen.
You couldn't work. Couldn't have a civil service job, and that's what it was.
Wow.
So once they got married, she had to move out of the RTE Singers, and she was a teacher. She taught Irish and music in Loretta Crumlin, and that's what it was like.
You were always destined for show business then, Richard. You were always destined. You had grown up listening to two opera singers in your house.
Well, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, and there was always kind of a, you know, some class of a party, music party, and like a mad bunch of very interesting people that would be in the house.
Sounds
all the
like
time.
A great household to grow up in.
It was. Well, yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, it was. And it's only, you know, like when you get older, you kind of realise, geez, that's like, because you assume when you're younger that everyone is going through a similar kind of, you know, everyone
of
has
course.
Mad people
yeah.
in their family. And but we had mad people in our family and outside our family. And they were all kind of, you know, congregated together at these music parties. Like, you'd have a massive Christmas party every year and somebody would do a turn. And people like, you know, I've said this before, but people like Michael Yates, so like W.B. Yates' son.
Jeez.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And Brian Boydell. I mean, it was mad.
Wow.
And I didn't know who they were. So I was like, oh, that's grand. Yeah. But I mean, wait till you see me doing me impression of your man over there.
It's like a Dublin version of the Von Trapps.
A little bit like that.
Yeah, that sounds like great, man. And Christmas, I'm sure, like with the array of people that was coming around to the house, I'm sure it was like... You know, You know, and your father just kind of thinking about, I know you were saying he was a tenor, but did he ever sing like anything kind of else outside of classical music? Would he be known to do like, say, a
ballad?
A ballad or maybe a, you know, Frank Sinatra tune or something like that?
He wouldn't have done Frank Sinatra, but he would have done ballads, all right.
Right.
But it'd be mainly, you know, those kind of, you know, a little bit like along the lines of, say, John McCormack, you know, John McCormack and... like Frank Patterson, that kind of stuff. Now, he wouldn't have been as kind of, you know, straight down the line as Frank Patterson. Frank Patterson, actually, he used to be in the house quite a bit as well.
And Frank Patterson kind of talked like that, you know. He was from Tipperary. And he had a show every Sunday, I think it was, called For Your Pleasure. And he'd sing these songs, and Selvin Eilie, the wife, would be playing the harp. And he'd be singing away, you know.
And I met him with my dad, and at that, I had just grown, like, you know, I was 15 or 16, and it was like I was taking some kind of hormones or something for growth, but I didn't know what was going on in my body. Like, I was like a windsock, you know what I mean? My limbs were kind of like, you know, and I was, ugh.
What's the story with
Richard? What height are you? You must be about 6'7".
I said, no, I'm about like 6'1", 6'2".
He said, not at all, no, sure, I'm 5'9".
And he was about 5'4". So I think he was trying to convince everyone, but they were much taller than they were to, you know, elevate his own height. Like, he must have been, it always struck me, he must have been going around the world going, God, that's a huge building over there, because I'm 5'9".
It's only a bungalow.
it's only a bungalow, yeah.
It's a massive little shed. God, that's like the Eiffel Tower.
Just
on the party. I'm fascinated with the party scene there in the house. Were people getting up singing? Were they singing opera?
They were.
It's amazing.
And they'd be singing together as well. My parents were in a group called the Dowland Consort, and that was like 12 singers, and there was always four part harmonies. And but it was very kind of, you know, it was conducted by this guy called Brian Boydell, who's like, he's famous in the classical music world in Ireland. And he was a good, like, really famous composer and all that. He was the head of music in Trinity and all that. And so there'd be a mix of that, and there'd be, just like amazing. My mother was a choir director as well, a choir conductor.
Yeah.
And so you'd have a big mix of different types of music. It was the Goethe Institute Choir she was the conductor of. And so you'd have lots of different people from that kind of place as well, coming in and singing. And then there'd be poets,
cultural melting pot.
Pretty much.
Failing.
I know, no, and it was actually just a gallery of different characters coming in.
They're amazing memories to have as a child growing up. Because I know, like, my dad...
Different parties.
No, my dad loved a song. My dad was a really nice singer as well.
Right.
And but it's a different kind of thing. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, my dad would have his friends come around, like your own father. And they, you know, some. But Keonis now, let Mick's gonna.
One
Mick's
voice.
Gonna, yeah, Mick's gonna sing a song now.
Yeah.
One man, one singer.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mick would get up and he'd bleed and he'd do whatever, the wind beneath my wings or.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that stuff that you just kind of carry through. And I don't know, is your mother and father still, are they still with us?
No, they're not.
They're gone.
No,
they're gone. It's the same as me own.
Yeah.
But you have their memories. And I think, I always say this on this podcast. When you speak about them, it keeps them alive, doesn't it?
Totally. And it's a real gift. I think it's one of the brilliant things about music is that it passes on. Do you know what I mean? And it keeps the memories alive. It keeps the people alive in lots of ways. Because you learn these songs from them. You know what I mean? And at the time as well, my ma's brother, Eamon, he just moved over to London. So two of her brothers kind of had to move over there for work and all that. And the only contact they ever had really was they'd either come over or they'd go over. They didn't really talk on the phone or whatever. But my ma used to, I mean, they talked on the phone, but they didn't, you know, not like now. She'd record herself. She'd be playing the piano and dad be doing a few songs. And then I started singing as well. I did an opera when I was 9, I started getting into it then.
Did you not know he was a singer?
No, not an opera singer, didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I just started out now. I wouldn't call myself an opera because I was 9. Like, but anyway, we recorded all these songs. Like, it was just like, you know, every few months or whatever, and we'd send them over to Uncle Eamon. Yeah. And he'd be like, it was his kind of, you know, connection with Ireland. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And So it was a nice way to keep in touch with it. But yeah, like, I mean, the songs I learned from that age and from doing that opera when I was nine, it was in my ma's school and they needed a boy. And like all the rest of the pupils were girls. So that was my first taste of being in a show, in a production with loads of girls.
And
Ma said, would you be interested in doing? And up until that point, I went, no, look, I'm not going to sing. I can't sing. And then she taught me the songs. Then, you know, I realised, actually, okay, I can sing all right. You know, I'm not too bad. But then when I saw the girls, I was like, I'm in. That's fine.
Yeah.
No other lads. Now I
can
do this. Just me.
Can you remember the opera, Restart?
It was called Amal and the Night Visitors. So it was written by Carlos Menotti, was the name of the opera composer. And it was like designed for kids. Like it was and it was on, it transferred to the RDS at that year. Like it was the Christmas opera. They used to do a Christmas thing every year. And so it transferred to there, and my dad was in it as well. Actually, he was the tenor in it. He was one of the kings, and my ma conducted it. So
no
it was
way.
Just yeah. So
a family affair.
It was a family affair kind of thing. Yeah.
And but so you obviously still carry a love for it and all. Do you still listen to it? Would you go to an opera yourself, kind of thing?
Yeah, I would. Now I would. I mean, there isn't that much opera on in Ireland, but yeah, no. If there's, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not obsessed with opera now, to be honest. Okay. Like I find some of it sort of a bit too much. Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, you calm down there. Do you know what I mean? It's
you can't be devastated with everything.
Here's a question for you. What opera would you recommend for the ordinary working class fella? Something that's simple and easy to kind of...
Carmen's a brilliant opera.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's a bit
mechanic.
Yeah.
Carmen.
Yeah, that's it.
Carmen.
And that's just a classic love story. Do you know what I mean? And that's
and that's the thing about opera, Rich, that you just humming that tune there. There's so many tunes that are familiar to people, and they go, oh my God, that's from an opera, that's from an opera. You know, I think people, if they went to an opera who've never been before, would recognise half the tunes that are being sang, especially amongst the classics. Like,
definitely. And it actually has a big influence over, you know, modern music as well. Like the likes of Beethoven, Mozart, Bach, a lot of people kind of sample those like famous compositions, and a lot of people don't know that, like, because if they're not into opera. But it's it's amazing how, like, it's the source of a lot of creative kind of compositions,
the origins.
You know Ballymun has a big opera singer.
Oh yeah.
No joke.
She's a soprano. Where do you know? Sorry, there's tenors and the sopranos.
Sopranos are women.
Women. So that's she's a soprano.
Yeah. Okay.
We're making a movie about her.
Jade Phoenix. Do you know her?
No.
So basically, she is she came up through Ballymun, Clondalk, and the family found her. She had this amazing voice. But the only kind of decent opera teacher in Dublin at the time was based outside of Dublin, Greystones.
Okay.
So the family relocated to Greystones. And now she's singing all around the world.
Right.
As this, but there's a movie has been made about her. La Breve Vida. The quick life, the short life, or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
So that'll be out in the summer, I think. But the film, I'm dying to see it, actually, just because it sounds fascinating.
Who'd have ever thought, you're going to go, what, an opera singer from Ballymun of England?
Well, the thing is, if you can sing, you can sing.
Yeah,
it shouldn't matter where you're from.
Yeah,
true.
It's just getting the opportunity is the thing,
isn't it? That's the thing.
Or the opportunity.
Oh, Jesus.
So there was a joke.
He was just setting you up for that.
If that qualifies as a joke.
We were doing, obviously, we like to do a little bit of homework on the guests that we have. And, you know, like, you have a glittering acting career. Mm-hmm. Like you have tread the boards in some serious venues, doing some serious plays. But would it be wrong in saying that maybe more people recognise you from Apprimatch than this incredible back catalogue of theatre work and TV work that you've done?
It doesn't matter what artistic endeavours I get up to and say,
yeah, you're the man off Apprimatch.
And you've done some amount of stuff. Oh, you actually didn't realise how much you'd done until I delved into your Wikipedia last night.
Right,
and
I was
like, Jesus Christ. And even from the singing, like, I knew you'd done a bit of singing, but I didn't know on that level. And I remember a good few years ago, myself, Gary, and Barry were in the National Concert Hall.
That's right.
We done a sketch in there one night.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, I mean, like, it's one of those things where, I mean, I've said this before a little bit about, you know, like, it's the impact, I think, that certain things make is obviously, you know, what you're going to be known for, like, especially here.
Yeah.
So, you know, when Apri Match started, like, there was really nothing else. Well, not that there was nothing else like it. There wasn't really anything else like it, that's for sure. But there was also, everyone was watching RTE.
Yes.
Everyone was watching the football coverage. First of all, we were good at football.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We were qualifying for things. The panel, there was always a bit of drama going on the panel. Yeah. And we fed off that. But there was a big focus. Whereas now, like, even if Ireland were good at football, it's just the focus is spread out. Like, you're not necessarily watching RT. People are watching Netflix. People are streaming. They're watching different things. You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the reasons why you're also, like, why I've been so associated with something like that, because it had an impact.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
It's part of our history almost. It's born into, etched into our brains, I think, Apri Match and a good Irish football team, Jack Charlton. When I think of Jack Charlton and that Irish Republic team, I think of Apri Match all the time.
Yeah,
me too. Like, they go hand in hand as far as I'm concerned.
Well, he would have been named one of the first impressions I would have done in the... I remember I was watching the telly. And he came on, and I thought, how is he getting the words out? Seeing as his chin is so far out.
But it was actually one of the first things. I mean, I remember telling my kids this, that I when I saw Dunphy and Bill on the panel, and there was just something about the connection between Bill, the spark between Bill and Dunphy, and there was a fella called Liam Toohey.
Oh yes,
as well. Yeah, he was on at the time, and
Bill would be, you know, asking these very kind of journalistic type questions of,
and don't say this is very important.
It's like he was, you know, analysing nuclear physics or something. and I just thought, this is brilliant. This is funny, like unintentionally so.
Yeah,
and
you had a potent landscape to work from, kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I had a little tape recorder, and I was always taping things at the time. I don't know why. But it was just something I was interested in, like, and taping people, like, you know, taping people's accents and voices. And
so you were interested in doing impressions from an early age.
I was
mimicking people. And
yeah, I think that's why I was able to sing as well. Like, the two were connected, I think, because I was repeating sounds all the time. And again, like, these are only things you're kind of thinking of now when you're a bit older, but I was able to, like, I was always obsessed with just unusual voices, and you know, like, even like, but I remember the Northern Ireland sport that used to come on BBC and all that, and my dad and myself used to kind of go around the house talking like that all the time, and, you know, about the whole, but also just the fact that all the results were so grim.
Yeah, you know. I'll never forget that sketch restart.
Yeah.
The Stillery.
The Stillery Crusaders versus the Stillery was a late kickoff.
Yeah, I know. It was just, and the reason that that sparked from the fact that remember we were watching BBC Grandstand, like, from London, right? And Northern Ireland Sports used to cut in on it.
That's right, yeah.
So I was watching for the Leeds-Liverpool result.
Yeah.
And the only way you could ever find out the result in those days was through this.
This was even pre-CFAX time.
Absolutely.
Pre-CFAX. They kept all the results out in the evening, didn't they?
Yeah.
Saturday evening, yeah.
Yeah, so it'd be like a vidi printer, as they call it. And David Colburn used to present Grandstand at those days. And the result has come in from Leeds United versus Liverpool at Elland Road. And we can now go over to the result. And it's...
Well, there may be action across channel, but that's all action drama and excitement here all the way in Belfast.
I remember it so well, Rich, then.
That was just a head wreck. And so I used to, like, the odd time I'd ring up the paper and find out, like, can you tell us the results? You know, that was the only way to find out. But yeah, I used to go around to the tape ground, and I went upstairs after getting back to that, after I saw Bill and Dunphy the first time. I went upstairs and just did my own version of what I saw. So I just kind of thought, and just Bill asking mad questions and Jack Charlton and all these different voices.
Brilliant.
Just started coming out. So that was, I guess, well, unknowingly at that point, that was probably the little did you know what was ahead,
kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, the relationship with Gary and Barry, Gary and Barry. I never actually realised that Gary and Barry,
Gary and Barry.
Yeah,
I know. Just
sounds
tell
like
me
the
about
most,
it.
The most London duo you'll ever come.
Gary and Barry.
Gary and Barry.
Yeah, I know.
What,
I know.
Son?
Yeah.
So how did that all come about then, Richard? Like,
Well, myself and Barry, like a lot of people, especially back in the day, used to mix us up because
similar height,
we were a little bit alike, and
you actually resemble each other a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm obviously much better.
No, you would definitely, if you said you were Barry's brother, I would definitely believe it.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a resemblance.
Yeah, yeah. I'm obviously much better looking.
No, you are. We were going to say that. Obviously. We were going to say that.
And healthier.
Barry's better looking brother.
Yeah, exactly. Barry's better looking and more modest. I'm better at golf.
Yeah, everything. Everything. Better, everything.
But no, I remember for people, how are you, Barry? And I was like, and I actually had a mate called Barry Mulligan. And I was maybe they thought I'm Barry Mulligan. I don't know. But for him, it was for Barry Murphy. It was worse because people said, "Oh, how are you, Richard?" And he like, "What is Richard? Like, you know, some kind of a disease." So eventually, we met, and I think I had seen him in the they were doing back in the day. They would have been doing comedy improv in the project.
Yes.
And so Ardle would have been involved.
Mr. Trellis, that kind of thing. That was around
Mr. Trellis,
that time.
And and Paul Tylock and the Quack Squad them. And I would have been doing plays. I was more in the more in the theatre world than the comedy world. And then, myself and Barry met, and we just sparked off each other. You know what I mean? We kind of made each other laugh, I was just, I remember one time we were at a party and we were doing voices and impressions and stuff, and you kind of realizing that there's actually people around us here who have
themselves.
We were kind of around, like people were around us kind of listening to what we were doing, so kind of sort of thought maybe we should do this.
So where did Gary come into the mix?
So Gary was I met Gary socially just through the theatre world. He was doing a play or something with a friend of mine, and I remember seeing Gary in the Abbey, and he was playing this New York cop, and I just thought his accent first of all was absolutely brilliant. In those days it was kind of unusual, I think, for like you'd see so many plays, see so many Irish actors doing American parts, and you'd just be going, here. But I just thought he kind of shone out in the production anyway. And we met and again had a great laugh and sparked off each other. And it sort of snowballed from there, really. And I introduced Barry to Gary. We did a sort of a demo. Barry was presenting a show called The End at the time on RTE, which is like a continuity announcer thing that he kind of made into more like sketches between the shows that he was introducing. And I did a few sketches with him in that as well. And that was actually, I think, the first time I had done Jack Charlton in that. Like, I was wearing a kind of a floppy hat. It's on YouTube, actually. And Barry's there on Frank. And with the square,
with the square head,
the wooden, the bottom, box on his head. I remember a few people in RTE said, "What's with the wooden box?" Don't ask. If you're asking that, So then it just connected with RTE Sport, and there was an editor in there, Tony Whelan, who I think really wanted to kind of push doing a bit more. Introduce a bit more comedy, a bit more edgy. Sort of left of field stuff. And I mean, there's no question about it. It is insane that it happened, because it wouldn't happen now. I don't believe it would happen now.
Why was that?
Because it's just like,
it's too safe at the minute.
It's there's a bit of that, but it's also like we kind of went in through the side door. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas now, I think you'd have to probably go through the proper channels. You'd have to kind of go through the variety department and propose this thing. And can you imagine even describing what Napery Match was? Do you know what I mean? Like, so we're going to be wearing wigs and taking the piss out of the people.
He's going to have a cardboard box on his head.
Salvador Dali series or something. Brilliant.
So the fact that it sort of like emerged, I think, was the only way it would have happened, as opposed to it being like a formal proposal. And
what an impact.
It was incredible. It was brilliant. It was brilliant for us. And I mean, to be fair to RTE as well, I mean, I've said this again before, like they get a lot of,
grief.
But I mean, at the same time, they do kind of give certain people a leg up, you know what I mean? And
they backed you.
They did. They did. Like, I mean, I wouldn't say, the heads in there necessarily knew what was going on. But certainly Tim O'Connor, head of sport, he was a bit of a maverick. And, he had his own ideas. And, I think, he did want something like that, So it was
the very first ever.
We were lucky.
Ever comedy show I was ever at in Vicar Street was Après Match Live. And I'd say we started talking in the early 90s, this was. Maybe mid-90s, I can't exactly remember. But it was my very first time in Vicar Street, and it was my very first time at a comedy show, if you will.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And just being blown away, going, oh my... And there was a part of me going into it, because I was obsessed with what he did. I watched religiously, and I'd record it and watch it over and over again. Me pissed myself. But that night, going into Vicar Street, I was kind of going, Jesus, I hope the lads can pull it off in a live show. And then just being blown away. If anything, was even better, because you were in the room, you know what I mean? And he could do a little bit, it's a bit more liberating for you, I suppose, because you're on stage, not on TV kind of thing. Like,
no, you know? Exactly. I mean, in some ways, it was sort of, it unlocked something, because it was a little bit more restrictive on TV, because you had to kind of hit certain marks, and duration-wise as well. Yes, you could only be on for 5 minutes or... I think when we started, it was actually a bit more, it was a bit looser, and we were just talking like shite for 6 or 7 minutes and, didn't know when we were supposed to finish. But it did have a bit more of a, an order on it after a while. But I think the first run we did in Vicar Street would have been, because that pretty much started in 98. Myself and Barry had done a few things in 96. but Après Match started on TV in 98. It was called Après Match because of the French World Cup. And then, but we didn't actually do any live stuff in Vicar Street until 2000. So, but we had no, and again, it was before the internet. We didn't really know like how it was going down with people or whatever. And I remember the first night we did Vicar Street, and it was just like there was loads of lads in the audience, and it was like being at a match, but we were the players, and they were the crowd. You know, and I want to almost make my car think, hey, you fucking freak.
Yeah, exactly.
But
it's great as well, because there's no restrictions. You can do what you want, really. You're not an RTE. You're not told to cross your T's and dot your I's. You can be who you want to be and say what you want to say, really.
Exactly. And you're right. I mean, there was a couple of... but it was amazing that how, like, especially doing it in Cork, and that was obviously a bit later around Saipan. If I did Mick McCarthy, the other... You fucking... McCarthy! Get off! McCarthy!
Which kind of led into it as well around that time doing the Ikeno.
Yeah, that's right. Ikeno was 2005, I think it was. We had a ball doing that. That was
and a good run as well.
It's funny.
It's
good run, funny you should mention Mick McCarthy, because he's in the news recently, giving out about the film Saipan, they made me out to look like a mug who was up for a jolly and wasn't happy with Steve Coogan's portrayal of him.
He was only 5'8".
5'8". That was the kid.
It's hardly his fault. He made me out to be like a northern numpty.
He was going on a jolly.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. It was an interesting watch, that clip, because it was like he was caught off guard or something.
Yeah,
like he didn't know there was cameras on him, but he did know there was cameras on him. He knew the thing was being filmed. It was a funny one. It was a funny one that he used the C word. Fair enough. But I was surprised that he went for it.
Yeah. Did you get to meet Keane yourself?
He came backstage. I wasn't actually in it, but he came backstage. I think it was like the third kind of reincarnation of Ikeno. No, I didn't. I've never met him when we were doing Ikeno. Right. I've met him subsequently a couple of times.
Right.
Not overly endowed with crack. he's good at providing comic relief if he's providing it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't like if anyone else does. He's a complex fella, I'd say, to be put it kind of politely.
I've known of it, I've told this before. I did the Soccer Writers Awards a few years ago. I was doing the comedy bit, and he was there. Martin O'Neill were the management team.
Yeah.
And we were sat in the front row.
Yeah.
And I went on stage, and Keane was my hero.
Yeah,
he was
a
Man United fan and all that. And I remember looking down and going, my God, Roy Keane's in the fucking front row here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew the one thing that would get the room on side was, so straight away I looked at him and I said, Roy, just before I start, I have one question to ask you. Any chance for an old selfie after this? And of course he went, no. the whole place exploded, and I went, great, I'm off and running. Yeah. And I did 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was looking down, he was laughing. I was going, here to myself, oh God, I'm making Roy Keane laugh here. And I walked off, and he leaned back and he says, you can have that selfie, but not in here in front of all these pricks. Come out in the lobby, and we do it on the sly. He says, yeah, no bother. Went out, we got the selfie together then.
And then he got, the head punch
on. Yeah.
But, so Rich, like, you're going on tour now. You're going on tour. Out of the head. What's it? Out of me head.
It's out of his head.
Out of his head.
Yeah.
What a brilliant name.
Be fitting for one of my shows from years ago. Used to be out of his head.
Yeah. No, it's kind of, it's it really comes from, I've had a whole load of things in my head, like a load of ideas in my head, and
getting them out.
And getting them out.
Yeah.
And also, and you know, lots of people who are not in this business say to me on a regular basis that it must help that you are out of your head. So I kind of go, well, yeah, it probably does, actually. But yeah, it's the first time I've done a whole show on my own. Like, I've done, you know, 20 minutes, half
slots.
An hour, and sometimes, you know, that kind of thing. But this is different. And yeah, a lot of people, like, in my, you know, I suppose, like, in my family and friends, close friends, would have been saying to me, like, you know, you have to do this. So I, like, you know, I've been going, oh, you know, I'm not sure I really want to do this. But then I did a work in progress version of the show in The Viking last September. And I just thought, like, before I went on, actually, being honest, before I went on, I thought, this is, why did I do this?
Yeah, like,
this is honestly the first night backstage. I was just going, this is just, I didn't need to do this.
But you always do. We even do it. Before you go on, and it's a walk, you know, it's a walk in progress.
Yeah.
You're standing at the back and the self-doubt and self-belief is like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But it literally is like, it's two extremes in your head, isn't it? Like, you know, I mean, I know you're kind of stating the obvious there, but it really is extreme sometimes. Mm. And, but yeah, literally like 5 minutes into it, I was going, well, hey, you know. Who was that backstage?
I love hearing that, Rich Dad. You got a buzz over, you enjoyed it. You're going, this is great.
Yeah. No, I did. Because a lot of the stuff I've done over the years, and like you're referring to that, you know, a lot of the stuff I've done in, say, in the theatre world, it's with other people.
Yeah.
And even with Apri Match, it's with other people. And there's a kind of a team. And I love being part of a team. I really do. Like, there's, I think in a way the buzz of that is better than anything. But it's a different buzz being on your own, and it's kind of, you learn more about yourself, I think, and just like it's kind of more rewarding and fun as well to give it a lash. And even, to be honest with you, even if, like, it has been going really well now, the show, I just did the Pavilion there in Dún Laoghaire on Friday.
Sold out, of course.
Yeah, it was sold out. It was great. Like, and to be honest with you, it's all kind of new territory for me, because I didn't really know what to expect. But yeah, no, it's been brilliant so far.
That's amazing, Richard. Like, I wonder, is like, were you even doubting, would people come to see you?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, because you just don't know, like, you know, and you don't know. You know, I suppose just the whole territory of selling a show on your own.
Yeah.
And like, again, when you're doing a theatre, like, I just did a play called Uncle Vanya, which is like, it's a very, you know, heavy drama. I mean, there's fun in it, there's comedy in it, but it's a very serious play. Anton Chekhov, Smock Alley. Wow. And it did really well. Like, I mean, the play itself, like, a lot of people came to see it. But you've no real idea. People are coming to see the play. People come to see this play. They come to see this production, and there's a lot of reasons for them to come to see it. But if you're doing a show on your own and it's just a comedy show and it's you, that takes time to build up. Do you know what I mean? As you guys both know, like, it's you need to be doing it for a while on your own for people to go, well, you know. But I suppose I've done a lot of stuff recently on my own online, like a lot of sketches
and off the ball and all
off
that.
The ball and during the pandemic I was doing a lot of stuff on my own as well, so it's kind of, that's fed into it, I think, as well a little bit. You don't also know, like, I mean, I did a gig in Kilmallock. It was the first, Kilmallock is County Limerick, that was the first gig I did on this tour. And
Kilmallock,
so it's a place called Friar's Gate, right, 40 kilometres outside of Kilmallock. And when you look up, I mean, I was just looking up, you know, something for, you know, anything for material. And you look up things to do in Kilmallock, and the first thing it says is visit Ballyhara. So in other words, get the fuck out of here. Yeah. Would be the implication. But it was just like, that's where the territory is new for me, where I'm going, like, how do you, I don't know who, what the makeup of that audience is going to be. And the one thing I've learned as well, if there's a GAA club local to the town that you're in, GAA stuff is going to work.
Yes.
So, yeah. Like, I mean, I kind of thought to myself, well, like, you know, like all the rugby stuff, for example, I'd have in my back pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I better give that, put that on the long finger. Yeah. And get stuck into whatever GAA material, yeah, I had. But it's things like that. It's like tailoring. And then that is where it's sort of new and interesting territory for me. Yeah.
And yeah, every audience, I don't care where you go to or where you play. I'm all right, Eric. I'm all right. Every audience, where you go or where you play, once you've got local references, be it the GAA club, the local pub,
yeah,
the shop down the road, the estate that's in the area, or something that's went on. And look at Google for that, is great, to Google the area and, yeah, see what's,
yeah,
went,
no,
on.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah,
and they always, yeah, love that. They love, they say, oh, he's taking an,
he's
interest
bothered,
in,
he's
the
bothered
place
to do it. Yeah, yeah. No, I, you think, know? That's right. Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. It's an interesting one.
I think you are an Irish institution, Richard, like, genuinely, like, from the après match thing and from your back catalogue of theatre work, I think you are an Irish, and I think the minute people see your face on posters, they're just going to go. I think there's that warmth towards après match. Like, anyone in my social circle for the last 30 years has been massive fans of that, you know? And I'm sure, like, my sons are in their 20s, but I'd be putting them, you know, watch these clips here on YouTube, whatever, and they're watching them, and they wouldn't necessarily know the characters, but they just fell around the place laughing at the sketch and the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
And they were like, that was on RTE. He was going, yeah, this is, yeah, on RTE. This is their entertainment during the football. And they're like, oh, man, they should do something like that today. But as you said, it probably wouldn't work today as much as it did then.
Yeah,
like,
well, they probably just wouldn't, I don't know, I'm not sure that you'd be let away. I mean, not just in terms of every match, but like, the way everything has become much more, yeah, sanitized, I, yeah, suppose, and I don't mean sanitized in terms of even just like language or whatever, mm-hmm, or what you're actually, like, the subject matter is. It's more just the general tone of stuff is just it's just all a bit sort of, yeah, safer.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I was listening to, I just find, you know, one of the big differences as well, say, between back then and what got me interested in it, like what I was saying earlier about Bill O'Hurley and Dunphy, what struck me as a kid about that was, it was the fact that there was two characters, two big characters sparking off each other. Whereas now, it's very clip-based, the analysis. Do you know what I mean? Let's have a look at that. Do you think he was offside?
Right.
Do you think he was onside? So there isn't really that opportunity for people to sort of develop their, yeah, you know, or for you to get to know people.
That's true.
Do you know what I mean? It's,
yeah,
all about, like, hitting marks, yeah, and it's all very, you know, let's have a look at this clip.
Yeah, let's run this piece back and see what you're doing here.
And you see the same thing over and over again.
Sky Sports around everything.
Yeah, yeah, it's all their fault. No, but it is. I think that's the same across all sport now. Mm. It's you know, and I just don't, I think it's a mistake, because most of the time you're going to be able to see that clip anyway on your phone. You're going to see it 100 times if you want, yeah, to, the goal from 10 different angles. But what you're interested in, what brings punters back, what people back to look at it, is the spark between the characters. You know what I mean?
And what was amazing about Apri Match as well, Rich Dard, was your ability to get stuff ready in a short space of time, I would imagine, because something big would have happened, say, on the day or the day before the World Cup, and, yeah, straight away you boys have a sketch done for it. Like, obviously we have sketches that are going to be ready, but then something big would happen, you go, we have to fucking mention this.
Yeah,
you
know, no, exactly, I mean?
And
exactly,
that brings its own pressure, but he's pulled it off time and time again.
We got better at that. I think, like, initially we were sort of, we would stick to, you know, hang on, it doesn't matter what happened. But I remember, again, with Saipan, we had released a single, can you believe it, called Okie Dokie Karaoke. You know, absolute, top quality.
Number one.
Is that on Spotify?
It was number one on the playlist in, yeah, St. Dietas Mental Hospital.
It was a very big moment in the music industry.
I'm sure your dad had loved that, wouldn't he?
Yeah. I think the chorus was, okie dokie karaoke, everybody sing along. You'll love the boys in green out in Tokyo, but you'll hate us for this song. So we were doing a publicity shoot for that in town there, and we were eating sushi off a model or something. I don't know. That's like what it was like in 2002.
Brilliant.
And then the next minute, like all the few press lads are there, photographers or everything are there, and we hear that Keane has gone home, and that was the end of their interest in us.
Get rid of me.
whatever. So we were right in the middle of obviously our prep for the World Cup, and we kind of thought, well, look, this might blow over, you know, but
no.
It certainly didn't blow over, and I'll never forget it. And people who are kind of, I don't know, under 20 or whatever now won't believe this, but like every program, I'll never forget this, every program on RTE the next day was dominated by that news. Like the Joe Live line.
Yeah.
Like everything. Yeah, it was like everyone getting their
swept
angles.
The nation,
like, swept the nation. Whatever was on in the afternoon in those days, it was all about that and what's the latest. And it was literally like 24 hours of Roy Keane and
incredible.
The story.
I've never seen that like it.
Incredible.
And come here, what's your take on it, Ristard, now looking back on it? Do you think he was right to do what he done?
I think it's really hard to have an opinion when you're not there, when you're not, you know what I mean?
Like,
at the time, like, I did actually think Keane was right, because you'd be sort of thinking, you know, we've all been around situations where you just think, like, why isn't the standard here higher in this country? Like, why don't we have a bit more belief in ourselves? Like, why isn't there this, that and the other laid out? And I mean, I suppose from his point of view, it set off alarm bells that, listen, you know, we're just here to make up the numbers.
Yeah.
And I did have a certain sympathy for him, but ultimately I think it was a selfish thing to do, and I think it was wrong. Like, if you're claiming that you're, you know,
a team player,
you're a team player, you're the captain of the team, you're representing your country, I don't think it really mattered what McCarthy said or did. He shouldn't have done the interview either, I don't think, Roy Keane.
Yeah,
I think that was one of the most watched pieces of TV in Irish history.
Yeah.
Everyone was just glued to it.
Yeah. No, but the interview that sparked was, that, you know, in the Irish Times.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
And he referred to, and it basically, he broke ranks, didn't he, and said, you know, that the standard of, you know, what's going on over here is, and he refers to the fact that it's jolly, and effectively, you know, had a go at McCarthy. So McCarthy was in a position where, like, what's he going to do? He has to tackle this, and all the squad knew about it. McCarthy probably didn't handle it the best way either, but, you know, he was, you know, probably got that wrong a little bit. But I still think Keane walking out, for what he said, I do think Keane's a bit of a hypocrite in like, in even what he's doing at the moment. Do you know what I mean? Like, in for years, he was saying he'd never be in, you know, an analyst and all that, and he'd prefer to go to the dentist and all that.
He was the golden child.
And ironically, he's become the Dunphy of Sky Sports.
Yeah.
He's like kind of rent-a-mouth, you know. I mean, to be fair to Dunphy, I think Dunphy is a lot more, and was a lot more of a considered pundit than Keane is.
Yeah.
You know, I think Dunphy, you know, definitely obviously liked his moment in the sun. So it's like, oh, fuck, I did. Oh, we're not on air, are we, Bill? We are, Eamon. Yeah, we're live on air, so you'll have to apologise to the nation now, and be the headline in tomorrow's Sun and the Star, which was the whole goal in the first place, if you forgot the pun.
And they were great. They were like, it was not only football, it was sheer entertainment you were watching.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When you looked, because it was unpredictable. You didn't know what was going to happen, like, you know?
No, well, it was part of the theatre. I mean, it's something, like, I suppose, that we all love about sport. Just the actual event, the match, is the fact that it's pure theatre.
Yeah.
But when you have mad fellas talking about it as well, as they were, and just like the way they sparked off each other.
It's like your Bill O'Herlihy, he will live forever, I think, in everyone's minds. The okie dokie, and they put it to you, I'm live, and all of that. And I was actually coming into town today, and I drove past the Back Page pub in Phibsborough, and the giant mural on the side, and it's Bill O'Hurley, and it's just okie dokie.
Go away,
and I'm going,
really?
That'll stem from Après Match. Yeah, I know he said it once or twice, but you just magnified that.
Yeah.
And that became part of who he was to everybody. Yeah. Like, you know, you see Bill O'Hurley, you're thinking, okie dokie.
Yeah, I know. No, it's mad. And it's funny what does become a catchphrase, because often, like, I think I started saying okie doke all the time because I couldn't remember what my next line was. So, okie doke. Just take a second here to remember what I'm supposed to be saying next. And there was one line as well that it was kind of, I got a much bigger laugh than I expected, because again, it was kind of a mistake. And Barry was beside me as Frank, and Gary was one up as Eamon. And my next line as Bill was supposed to be for Eamon. So I said, if I can turn to you first of all, Frank, and then I realised I should have been asking Eamon. So if I can turn to you first of all, Frank, and ask you, Eamon. So it was one of those ones that kind of, it seemed like it was probably a line that was written. But
yeah,
was,
you know, yeah, yeah. But that's the beauty of Après Match. That's what I loved about it. What was the Barry question?
Completely left field question for you. How do you get Twink to put on a set of roller skates to wear?
You know, when you're as good looking as we are.
Because I text Barry before I come in, and I said to Barry, I says, we have wrist out on. I says, is there anything? I says, nothing embarrassing. I said, but Ant that kind of comes to mind. And he threw a few things at me to say. But one he was saying for the 1,000th episode, was it, of one of the things, Twink come in with a pair. He said, ask him how he got.
That's right. She was in the rollerblades. And it was actually during the, it was live. Can you believe this? During the 3rd from 4th place playoff.
Oh, when you were hosting.
That's right, yeah.
Got a swing from the chandelier. Came on, and she comes in.
How did you do that?
Just, you know.
Charm.
But zipping up your Mickey wasn't involved. That was not a factor in it.
The Après Match boys at that time were like the Beatles. They could get anything they wanted.
This is it. Yeah.
That third, 4th place playoff team where you hosted from the moment, like, was that something that just happened kind of shortly before you did it, or was it always in the mind that you would eventually get to do something like this?
Well, we had the idea to do it based on the fact, I think, that the first year we did it, because the 3rd place playoff, the two teams were shite. I mean, they weren't shite because they got to the semi-finals, but the fixture was just like, it was like inevitably going to be
friendly, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was like Turkey against somebody, and they always, like, they pick their second or third string team.
All the lads who didn't get a game,
But again, like, with RTE, it was mad because, like, I think FIFA probably were saying, so, you know, can you imagine, like, some German fellow from FIFA saying, oh, so I had 3 comedians presenting a very important flagship, the second most important game in the World Cup.
We went on for the crack, aren't we?
We went on for the crack, yeah. So it was like, we knew that we'd end up, like, hosting some of it. We didn't know that we'd, like, actually take over the main chairs. So we thought we might, you know, do a sketch at the end of it, as per usual, but maybe have a bit more input. But then they said to him, no, you can actually do the whole thing. So,
wow.
So it was literally like I was sitting in Bill's, like, real Bill's chair.
Yeah.
And it was like Alice in Wonderland or something. You're going, or, you know,
feel the power.
Goldilocks and the three bits. It's like, somebody's been sitting in my chair. It was a really bizarre feeling, particularly live TV with knowing everybody's watching.
Yeah.
And even like in those days, even though it was like the 3rd place playoff, not an important fixture, we knew that there was like lots of eyes on us, and you could just go, you know, off piece.
One way or the other.
Yeah, the audience kind of have to go with you. Also, you have somebody in your, like, it was new to me as well. Like, you have the producer in your ear going, actually, no, keep talking, Richard, because we can't go to Stephen Alkin, the live. So you actually have to
stay in between the lines and
maintain some kind of, you know, equilibrium, talk about actual things, but also being going okie doke and live and whatever. We have to take a commercial break or whatever. So pretend that you're sane as well as being slightly mad at the same time.
Sorry, I meant to ask you as well about the show that you're doing at the moment, Richard, the live show. What is it like? What's it? Can you give us a little insight as to what it's about?
Yeah, it's there's impressions sort of throughout the whole show, and there's a bit of political stuff. There's current affairs. There's, you know, I suppose the cultural landscape of TV and. I put characters into unusual positions and people would be familiar with me doing, say, Pat Kenny.
Yes.
And I put him into a kind of, but I do this sketch as well with Graham Norton. There's a lot of new impressions in there.
That's
as well.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to give too much away, but I put Graham Norton in with a character who basically doesn't play the game, you know, being a chat show guy, like, you know, the Graham Norton says, "Oh, hello," and we have a sofa chock full of Hollywood superstars, and it's just somebody who's his guest kind of going,
not into it. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see about that, won't we? Yeah. I'm actually quite depressed.
So there's something basically for everybody in it.
There's a bit of everything in it. There's sport. There isn't as, like, there's nowhere near as much sport as we would have done, say, in a pre-match. But there's I do a bit of sport, sports characters, and I'll do a bit on the matches, like, you know, the World Cup and all that. George Hook, he's there, and There's the thing that I do with Pat Kenny seems to be kind of one of the most popular things, and it's just like what his next move might be career wise. And I do a bit of on the Late Late Show. I look back on old TV shows as well, and how they, I suppose, the difference between now and then, like what you can get away with now compared to, like, kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And how just how, I suppose, subject matters change. I do a sketch on, you know, Housewife of the Year with Gay Byrne, and
I mentioned this recently, the Calla Cosingas Housewife of the Year.
And we have a bit of crack with that. I get the audience involved as well. Songs, and there's music.
You're like a Swiss Army knife of entertainment.
I want to, you know, I want to really, I suppose, do everything I can do, you know what I mean, and give everything a lash,
but you have it all. You've the comedy, you've the impressions, you've the singing. So it's like it's a one for all voucher for everybody.
Well,
like,
you're hoping that that's what people pick up on and people enjoy it. But you know yourself, you don't really know until you do it. You just don't know.
But it's great even hearing you talking about the Viking is such a small and intimate theatre. And you're going out and you're kind of second guessing yourself, as you said, you know, backstage. And then you go out and in 4 or 5 minutes you're going, Jesus, this is actually going on.
What was I worried about?
It was. And then we are our own worst critics. We give ourselves a hard time.
Well, I think the thing to always remind yourself is that, you know, if you get in your own, you're not doing yourself any favour if you start putting, you know, hurdles there before you've even given yourself a crack at it. You go, that probably won't work because, you know, you know what I mean? Give it a go. And like the worst that can happen is that you'll fall flat in your face and be miserable and never do it again.
You have a lot of dates coming up, Richard. So if people wanted to go and get tickets, they would go and visit
richardcooper.com.
richardcooper.com. So it's RISTEARD Cooper.com.
I'm going in the Civic in Tala on April the 2nd. That's Holy Thursday. And
nice.
Then Westport, then the next day, Good Friday.
Brilliant.
So looking forward to that now. Civic is there's a good bunch coming to that,
and there's you're happy with the sales at the moment?
Yeah, they're going well. I'm doing really well in Dublin. There's Westport now on Good Friday is a bit of a hard sell.
All up the mountain, to be all up St. Patrick. Yeah,
I might do the gig up there.
In your bare feet.
Hey there, I'm doing Pat Kenny.
We're just fucking idiots.
Yeah. I done an event down there, the Gale Force West, a few years ago, and there's actually a shop on the top of the locals call it the Reek. That's what they call it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was a fella there selling, as you say down the country, tins of minerals and chocolate and crisps. And it's just like a few boxes of things, you know. And I went over to him and said, any chance of a quick pick, you know, the lotto tonight?
Yeah.
And here are you staring at me, you know? There's nothing in the bleeding shop.
Right. I'm conscious of the time restart because I know you have to leg it.
Well, really, come here. We're really honoured to have you in and glad that you called in.
Thanks very much. That's very much.
It was really enjoyable. It's great just to get you in and just have a chat, like have a bit of crack.
Cheers, boys.
Rista Cooper, one of the Irish greats in Irish comedy. He is touring to a theatre near you. Go and see him. You will not regret it. You will have the time of your life. Yeah. Rista Cooper, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, boys.